It's time for Let's Talk with Brian Pettaway.
Good morning, happy Sunday, and happy Labor Day weekend. I hope you guys are having a great weekend, a very festive one. Today I'm going to rerun the show on vaginal health that I did a couple of weeks ago. I got a lot of hits on it. People learned a lot, and they're asking me to rerun it again for people who did not hear it. So I'm going to actually do that today. Dr. Yolanda Lawson taught us a lot of great things. So men, here's your second opportunity to learn some things about women that you may not have known. I'm going to run that. I also have some new stuff from the Petty today. And I'm going to talk about a couple of things before we get to my guest. But I do want to tell you, next week is going to be the anniversary, one-year anniversary show. I can't believe it's been a year already, but it's been 1 year. So I'm ramping up for that show. That's going to be a great show. But in the meantime, today, before we get to our guest, I'm going to give you some news, some things that's gone on this past week that I thought would be interesting to you. And also, I want to talk to you a little bit about Labor Day. So I hope you're feeling great, because I am feeling great this Labor Day weekend. I got lots to talk about, so let's get right to it. Fox 45 is reporting that instead of starting a new school year, a 14-year-old was arrested at school last week and is now facing more than a dozen charges in connection to the Brooklyn Day mass shooting. News of the teen's arrest, whose name will not be released, was made public during a news conference with Mayor Brandon Scott, Baltimore Police Acting Commissioner Richard Worley, Baltimore City State's Attorney Ivan Bates, and federal law enforcement partners. Aaron Brown, 18 years old and also another suspect in the case, was also arrested and is facing 68 charges. Ahead of the legislative session in January, questions are now being asked after this arrest about what path Governor Wes Moore will take when it comes to the juvenile justice laws and possible amendments. Governor Moore has already said that addressing juvenile crime is a priority for his administration and called for some changes, but has yet to reveal the specifics that he will change. He has also said that a special session will not happen. I'm all for changing the juvenile law. I think that right now children are too protected by these laws, and that at some point, at some age, when you know right from wrong, which is fairly early, I would say 13, and I don't mean you need to be charged as an adult or sent to an adult prison, but there needs to be some accountability at that point, because at 13, you definitely know right from wrong. I also believe that parents should hold some responsibility for their children's actions. I mean, if we're not going to charge minors because they're too young, we have to have their parents held accountable and be responsible for their children's behavior in some capacity. But I'll also say this, I don't put all of this on kids or on parents. There has to be something for these kids to do. We can change all the laws and make them stiffer, make the penalties more severe for crime, but until we give young people something to do in this city, to make them feel special, to make them feel responsible, to give them some pride in something that they do where they can earn some money or hold a position as children between the ages of, I say, 11 and 18, crime is going to continue to rise. And until we start investing more money, and I'm saying more money, into the education system, the public education system in Baltimore City, we're going to continue to see crime rise. If kids are failing out of school, if kids are not going to school, if kids don't feel good about being in school, they are going to go to crime. I mean, it's really that simple. There is a proven, definite correlation between poor education and high crime. It's an undeniable fact. So let us do the right thing. Let's invest money in programs for these kids and also invest money in the education program. I don't know why we don't do it. I don't know why we haven't done it. And to be very upfront, honest, and clear, I have zero faith in our mayor, Brandon Scott, unfortunately, and I even have less faith in Dr. Sonia Santelices, who is the president of Baltimore City Schools. I have very little faith in her. So yes, we definitely need to stiffen the laws, and the penalties need to be more severe for juvenile crime and juvenile criminals. However, in that same breath, I have to say, we as a village have to take responsibility for our lack of putting more pressure on our local government official to hold the president of Baltimore City Public Schools, Sonia Santelices, accountable for repairing the failures, which are many, in our Baltimore City Public Schools. And we also have to hold the mayor accountable for not providing programs for these kids when the school day has ended and during the weekends, and especially during the summer months when juvenile crime has gone through the roof. We have to provide them something to do that gives them pride in what they do and earns them some money. Otherwise, with the inevitable stiffer penalties that are coming and amendments to juvenile laws that are already on the books, we're just going to have a bunch of young kids locked up. And that's something that we should avoid at all costs. All right, on the national front, President Biden arrived in Florida yesterday to survey damage after the powerful hurricane made landfall in the state's Big Bend region. But politics are threatening to overshadow that visit. The state's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, who is seeking the Republican nomination to face off against Biden in the 2024 presidential election, says he does not plan to meet with Biden while Biden is there. And as we all know, it is customary for the president and the sitting governor of a state to meet after a natural disaster. So, once again, a perfect example of politicians putting their personal interest before the interest and well-being of the people who actually put them in office. Also in the news, sadly, is the passing of game show host icon Bob Barker. Now, my introduction to Bob Barker was at 5 years old when he hosted a show called Truth or Consequences in the 70s. Now, but I grew to really appreciate him and his style and his talent and his ability to make people comfortable at home and in the studio audience in the 80s when he became the game show host of The Price is Right. And he was on that show for like 1,000 years. Actually, it was only 35 years. But in that 35-year span, he hosted over 6,500 Price is Right episodes. 6,500. So it's safe to say that he was the gold standard for game show hosts. And I and millions of people around the world will miss him. Bob Barker, dead at the age of 99. Rest in peace. So really quickly, I wanted to give an explanation of Labor Day, while we celebrate it, while we have it, and what it actually means. Basically, the holiday is rooted in the late 19th century when labor activists pushed for a federal holiday to recognize the many contributions workers have made to America's strength, prosperity, and well-being. Now, before it was a federal holiday, Labor Day was recognized by labor activists and individual states. After municipal ordinances were passed in 1885 and 86, a movement developed to secure state legislation. New York was the first state to introduce a bill, but Oregon was the first to pass a law recognizing Labor Day on February 21, 1887. During 1887, four more states, Colorado, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York, passed laws creating a Labor Day holiday. By the end of the decade, Connecticut, Nebraska, Pennsylvania had all followed suit. By 1894, 23 more states had adopted the holiday, and on June 28, 1894, Congress passed an act making the first Monday in September of each year a legal holiday. That is how we got Labor Day, and it really is to mean we appreciate what you've done, we appreciate what you're doing, don't do anything today. All right, so what I told you at the beginning of this hour was that I was going to replay the interview that I did with Dr. Lawson, Dr. Yolanda Lawson, who is the president, the new president of the National Medical Association. And that is exactly what I'm going to do right after this break.
Sean E. Merriman presents An Evening with Kiki Wyatt. Kiki Wyatt.
We'll be loving to the brink of the day.
Her special guest, Keith Washington, and the sultry Miss Crystal F. Saturday, September 23rd, 6 p.m. at the James Weldon Auditorium at Coppin State University. Get your tickets at SeanEMerriman.com. This is a Ticketmaster event.
All right, welcome back to Let's Talk. And today my guest is the new president of the National Medical Association and a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist. She is the founder of Made Well OBGYN in Dallas, Texas, and an associate attending at Baylor University Medical Center. She is also the medical director of Abounding Prosperity, a community-based organization that addresses HIV disparities in target black communities. So, like I said before, when I want to know something, when I want to talk about a subject, I try to find the most qualified people to discuss this topic with, someone that will give me the right answers, the proper information, so that you and I together can learn something. So I think I got the right person today. In fact, I know I have the right person today. And so I'm going to hit her over the head with some questions that men are curious about when it comes to the vagina. It's going to be clinical. It's not going to be any ratchet or in the gutter stuff, but at the same time, it's probably not appropriate for kids. I would say 17, 18 is old enough to listen. So, you know, make the decision for yourself as parents. Also, I'm going to talk to the good doctor about dementia and why Baltimore is listed by the World Health Organization as having one of the highest dementia and Alzheimer's populations in the country. Need to know why that is. So we're going to talk to her about that as well. So buckle up and get ready. And right now, please help me welcome to 1500 Radio and Let's Talk, Dr. Yolanda Lawson. All right, 1500 family, please help me welcome to Let's Talk the new president of the National Medical Association, Dr. Yolanda Lawson. Good morning, Dr. Lawson. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I am so well. Thank you for being here with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Absolutely. Listen, you're going to help me shed some light on some things that not only am I curious about, but a lot of guys, and I'm sure some women are curious about, but most guys like me, we have, you know, we don't really have a whole lot of an idea of what women are talking about when they talk about these things. So you're going to help me with those today, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, first of all, president of the National Medical Association, that's a big deal. Like, how are you selected into that position?
So it is an elected position.
Okay.
I served at every level, from my local level to my state level, regional. So it's a work in progress, but it's an elected position. And to lead the Black doctors and help lead advocacy for Black patients in this country.
Okay. Now, when you say Black doctors, so this is a Black organization?
Yes. Yeah, so historically, Black physicians were not allowed into the American Medical Association. So the National Medical Association was born out of a need for us to have a platform for our educational advances and for what you needed to get hospital privileges, right?
Right.
And so it was born out of the need for African-American physicians to have a platform and a place for that.
Wow. So even, that's crazy. So now are Black doctors now welcomed into the American Medical Association?
Yes, Black doctors are welcome into the American Medical Association. In the late 80s, the president of the AMA came to the National Medical Association and a public apology was provided to the Black doctors. And so there are now reconciliation acts still going on to this day. As you can imagine, there was a lot of pain associated with those discriminatory acts in the past.
Okay. So now, are white members welcome into the National Medical Association?
Of course.
Okay.
Anyone who is in this fight to eliminate healthcare disparities is welcome into the National Medical Association.
Well, that's what's crazy to me, that there is still, I guess, a need for both. Like, I would assume, just like, you know, like baseball, like it, like things would, I don't know, integrate, and there wouldn't be a need for both, or there wouldn't still be a national and an American. You know, you guys are trying to, I guess, have the same success in taking care of medical issues. So it's kind of interesting to me. But it is a big deal. And obviously with this office that you hold now comes huge responsibility. So can you tell me the kinds of things or issues that you'll be tackling and managing in the position?
Absolutely. So I'll just highlight a few things. One is the Black Women's Health Agenda. And so I am an OBGYN by specialty. I practice also in Texas. And so maternal and reproductive health have been cornerstone to my career and history. And so that's one of my bucket areas. Okay. Also within that, cardiovascular disease, as you understand, leading cause of death in this country for all folks, but definitely when you began to discuss Black folks and you look at Black women are some of the most hypertensive beings on the planet.
Wow.
And then lastly, HIV. When you look at HIV, is a fifth leading cause of death in Black women. And so Black women also have some of the highest rates of new HIV infections. So some of these topics are within my Black women's health agenda. Also digital health. And so we keep hearing about digital innovation and AI and how it's supposed to close these disparity gaps and help us, right?
Right.
I want to ensure that these innovations are not widening the disparity gap, but actually closing those inequalities.
Okay.
And then lastly, the healthcare workforce, as you, I'm sure everyone heard, you probably have explored this over the past few years. You heard about burnout in physicians, and
yes,
especially after COVID.
Yes.
And I personally have lost colleagues who committed suicide.
Oh, wow.
And so when you hear that white doctors are burned out, what do you think is happening to our Black healthcare providers, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, all of that within the bucket.
I have a lot of work to do, Brian.
Yeah,
you do. Yeah, you do. But have you found any, or are you finding any pushback being a Black woman and having this title as president?
So I'm 2 weeks in. I don't think that I can say within this title yet I've experienced any pushback. I think that there have been some very strong women who have paved the way before me. And I appreciate and respect all of the work that has been done ahead of me.
Right.
But as a whole and Black women, you know, if you think about the past 5 years, remember on the airline flight, the Black female doctor
tried to help resuscitate
a patient and being questioned about being a doctor.
Yep.
One of my colleagues walked into a patient's room. She had her name with the letters MD on her white coat. And the white male patient asked her, "Oh, does that mean you're from Maryland?" And so you're right. We envision, right, when you think about who a doctor is. And so I am proud to step into this role and represent as a Black woman in this country and let people see my face and what that's associated with.
That is awesome. So at what age did you start becoming interested in medicine, but in particular gynecology? What got you interested in medicine and gynecology?
So I became interested in medicine in 10th grade. I remember taking physics, and I know that sounds strange, but physics, and I just began to fall in love with the life sciences. So I'm actually a zoology major, right?
Right.
So life sciences interested me. And so I knew by 10th grade I was going to pursue medicine. I went to medical school, and there were two things I was not going to do. I was not going to do pediatrics and OB. Those were two things I was not going to do. Okay.
Okay.
But again, I come from a family. I was the first doctor in my family, and it had to do with exposures. And so once I got into medical school and I got exposed, I fell in love with women's health. Okay. Women's health was it for me, and I knew it 100%.
Interesting. Interesting. Huh.
So it was a little bit of a curvy road, but you know.
Yeah, a little bit.
To you. Yes, things become revealed to you.
Well, listen, it's been well documented, kind of like you mentioned before, that healthcare for Black people in this country have been historically far less adequate or available than for white people in the country. Is that still a huge disparity gap in 2023, or has it gotten better? Is it getting better?
As you know, there are still huge disparity gaps. We can start with, you know, I just alluded to HIV. HIV has now become a disease mostly in the South, and mostly those disparities are greatest between Black folks, not only in disease acquisition, access to PrEP therapy, access to treatment. I'm an OBGYN. You've heard a lot around maternal mortality.
Right.
How Black women three times as likely to die. You could be well off, live in the suburbs, college educated. Those women are five times as likely to die as a Black woman. So even in that instance, right, we hear this argument about the socioeconomic status. That's an instance where that doesn't even matter, right?
Right.
And so you look across many disease states. We're starting an initiative now around the mortality rate or the death rate of Blacks from cancer. You look at Black men, the death rates from prostate cancer. We look at colorectal cancer, breast cancer. Black women die more. And so all of these things, tremendous burdens on our community. So absolutely, Brian, there are still healthcare disparities, and we're working to address those daily.
Tell me about, because I know you know, you're the director of Abounding Prosperity, correct? And that addresses HIV disparities in the Black communities,
if I'm
correct, right? What are you doing, or what is your foundation doing? What are you doing to help that? Like, how do you address it? Like, what do you do?
Absolutely. You've done your research on me. So, yeah, Abounding Prosperity is a community-based organization here in Dallas, Texas. It's located in a medical desert or a medically underserved area. Many of our clients may be unfunded or not being uninsured. We knew that there was a a gap. Previously, I'd started an HIV testing initiative that was faith-based in a zip code that had one of the highest rates of HIV in the Metroplex here. And so much of that work is about access, not only access to treatment, access to prevention methods like such as PrEP, you heard me talk about. We deliver transgendered care, and it's all about access and care. And how do these communities that are underserved, you keep hearing me say this underserved word, we get healthcare back into those communities?
Well, there are medical deserts in Black communities, and I think that's a huge issue. They talk about food deserts, which is true. But they're medical deserts also, and oftentimes Black folks don't have, you know, they don't have the transportation. So if you're going into the communities, I mean, that's incredibly helpful, incredibly helpful.
It is absolutely. And so one of my passions is around access to care. I opened a birth center several years ago in a community. And so you think back historically, healthcare was in the community, right?
Right.
Now we are used to or accustomed to these large major centers or university centers where all the doctor's offices and healthcare is in a center. And so you're right, there was something to it where healthcare and the doctor was in the community. I think back to the Cosby Show.
Right.
You remember he would go next door?
Had it in his basement. Yes, he did.
Right, in the basement.
In his basement, absolutely.
You remember that? So when I opened my, I could just remember him going next door, working and coming home.
Right.
Going back, being in the community.
Well, what's weird is when things were more segregated, and I've asked a couple of my guests this, who are activists within the Black community and older. And like my grandfather told me, he says he didn't know if integration was something that helped or hurt us more, because when things were more segregated, we were almost self-sufficient. We had teachers, we had doctors, we had all these things within our communities that we could depend on, and they were a phone call away. But it doesn't seem to be the case anymore. It's gotten a lot more difficult for us to get the care that we need.
It has. One of my mentors says the exact same thing. When we were self-sufficient, we relied on one another. And so you look at these things and these systemic and these large institutional structures, and you look at systemic racism. So absolutely, did you say that was your grandfather that said that?
Yes.
Yes, your grandfather was a wise man. And so you think about this. My mother was just having this discussion with me the other day around, she went to a segregated high school.
Right.
And what that was like, having teachers who were personally vested in your education. And you felt that through and through.
Exactly. Now, are you trying to incorporate that same kind of personal care within your practice, where you kind of know who you're dealing with?
I have always had that approach. I have always had that approach. You know, I realize being a doctor, I'm part of a system, right?
Right.
I've worked in healthcare systems. And so when Black patients interface with those systems, I realize I'm a part of that system. I think that us in this country trying to get to racially concordant care, and you know what that is, Brian? That's when Black or like people are taking care of like. We know that studies have shown that when Black patients can get better outcomes with Black doctors, but you also know the gap and the disparity in the number of Black doctors, right? There's a larger Black population than Black doctors.
Absolutely.
So how do you get there? And so I've always had that approach, and always I feel many of my colleagues, that burden is on our shoulders. We have to do more for our patients. I have to almost overcompensate to ensure the care that they need. They get the care that they need.
You know, I don't know if this is true, but I have heard, and I kind of want to know, are more C-sections performed on Black women, and are they unnecessarily done than there are on white women?
Brian. that can be the case, yes.
Okay.
That can definitely be the case. It can be multifactorial. right?
Okay.
You can look at, so I'll give an example. Black women, for instance, we have higher rates of preterm birth.
Okay.
Right? And so preterm birth is a complication of pregnancy. And so when you're thinking about preterm birth in itself, sometimes those babies aren't positioned properly. So in itself, with that being a complication of pregnancy, that could put you at a higher risk for cesarean. So there are just intricacies and nuances there that can impact the C-section rate among Black women.
Okay.
And much of it has to do with having higher risk pregnancies. And then most commonly, and what I love to talk about is the higher age women are getting pregnant now, right?
Right.
So women are delaying childbirth many times. And with delayed childbirth, the older you are, the more risk you have for complications such as preeclampsia and hypertension, and twins even are high. So higher risk at twins the longer you wait to get pregnant. So all of these are nuances.
Okay. All right. You know, you hear things and you don't know if it's fact-based or if it's just conspiracy. And I've heard that, and I heard a long time ago, and I always wanted to know if that is in fact was the case. So there are a couple of things. You know, when I mentioned to people that I was going to interview you today, they had a couple of questions. It was mostly men. All right.
Okay.
So help me out here, because we want to know. All right. One of the things is in regards to menopause and hot flashes. Is there anything that men can do to help women when they're going through hot flashes, and what causes it?
Okay. I love that question. So what causes menopause? I'm going to start there first. So when a girl is born, we're born with so many eggs, right? From the ovaries. Remember that seventh grade health class.
Right.
So you're born with so many eggs. All menopause is once your eggs are gone, then your ovaries basically fail. So it's ovarian failure is what menopause is by definition. The ovaries won't produce eggs anymore. That's why menstruation stops. And all of that creates the hot flashes and the vasomotor symptoms and the night sweats, right?
Okay.
And so it is a natural phenomenon. It is, I don't look at it as a disease state. I ask women to embrace the time. It is a change. And that's why they always called it, right? The change. You're going through the change.
Right.
And so
right.
It is a change. And I think men can be supportive.
Okay.
Right. I tell men all the time, you know, when it comes to the sweating, or she needs to turn, have the fan on, she needs
right.
to have the AC, Lord, just get your blanket, but don't say anything.
Okay.
Right. And so
okay.
support is needed, because, you know, when you're hot, and so you hear about women being irritable, right? That's a common thing. And so many times, if you think about even a child, when you don't sleep well, you're irritable. And so the sleep disturbances, because of becoming hot at night, are very common. And so we think much of the irritability comes from purely just not sleeping
well.
Lack
of sleep. Okay, that makes sense. And what are the stages of menopause? Like, there's menopause, perimenopause, like post, like what are the stages?
Right. So when we are in our child-rearing years, from the time we go through puberty, a woman is premenopausal. You're premenopausal all through your teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever. The average age of menopause in the United States is around 51 and a half to 52 years age. And so when you're around the time of menopause, the Latin root of peri is around that. So it could be your late 40s, your perimenopause.
Okay.
Right. So women just may only demonstrate some hot flashes. Their cycles may be a little bit irregular, but it takes usually about a 5-year process to get to menopause.
Oof.
So you become then, once you get to menopause, then you're considered postmenopausal. And that means you haven't had menstrual cycles for at least a year, right?
Okay.
Most people will see their doctor by then because of the hot flashes or what have you. There are some women who have very little symptoms, and there are some women who have more than others, right?
Okay.
But it's usually about a 5-year process. You don't just wake up one day and you're in menopause. That would be an ugly trick, right?
That would
so,
be.
You're right. Mother Nature usually guides you through it. So it's a process. Again, that's why it's called the change.
Okay, now here's another one, okay? And it's a very sensitive concern that affects women and ultimately affects her partner, as in us.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
It's vaginal odor. What are the primary causes and remedies or preventive care for that? And what can men do? What can we do to help lessen those things?
So if there's one thing folks should walk away with, a vaginal odor is not normal. And if you have one, please see a healthcare professional, because many times people seek over-the-counter methods, right?
Okay.
So I encourage folks, if it is the man and he notices it, he says something to you. I often ask the patients, has he noticed it? And so if you have that, please seek care for it first, because the first thing everyone's going to be concerned about, of course, is some type of infection. And so we want to control if it's sexually transmitted or not. We want to discern that. Not all causes of vaginal odor are sexually transmitted, but you want to make sure it's not, because okay. we want to control disease states for men and for women, right?
Right.
And then secondly, again, get testing to see what it actually is. Too many times people presume, and people are pursuing over-the-counter methods, boric acid and all these other things that are sold over-the-counter, douches, and which can aggravate the problem. You may get temporary relief, but it will come back.
Okay.
And so we do not recommend those things. So it's so important to understand, because you can complicate your diagnostic picture by not seeking care earlier and using these other things to mask your condition.
Are there, how can I ask this question? Are there differences in men and women to the point where you could be, I guess, in a relationship with someone who's throwing your pH off as a woman? Like, how do you remedy that? Because I hear that pH balance is such an important ingredient to having a healthy vagina. So what
yes.
is it something where a man can actually be throwing that off by like soaps he's using or lotions he's using? Like, is that a thing?
So first I want to clarify, usually the soaps and the lotions are not the culprit.
Okay.
If you have some type of infection, you can then have a pH balance change. We
okay.
know infection will create a pH balance change. There are things that you can do, of course, that can affect your pH balance. You just heard me say douching, probably
right.
the most common. Right?
Okay.
There are bacteria everywhere on the body and the skin. You can't control that. There are good bacteria and bad bacteria in the vagina. The vagina is an open orifice, just like your mouth is.
Right.
Right?
Right.
An open orifice. We all know there are bacteria in our mouth. Right?
Right.
And so when you douche and you wash out, right, the bad bacteria, you also wash out the good bacteria, and you create changes in pH balance, and then you can allow the bad bacteria to take over, hence the odor and bacterial vaginosis and all these other conditions, right?
Right.
And so many times women may say, oh, it's soap, I can't use, you know, soap with fragrance and things like that. Well, typically you've been using soap probably your whole life. Your mother bathed you in soap, things like that. So there
right.
can be harsher soaps. I don't advise, but typically there can just be something underlying. Typically, it's not that soap is necessarily causing it.
Okay.
But I know that that is a thought that and a myth that is propagated all the time.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
I'm very, very aware.
Okay.
And so in regards to men, yes, men can have non-sexually transmitted infections also. So typically, I'll give you an example. When it could end up, and it may not be diagnosed until fertility. I'm looking at a gentleman's semen analysis, and I'll see things, cells that fight bacteria. He may not have had any symptoms at all. His partner may be the person who presents with recurring vaginal infections and odor, right?
Okay, I got you.
And so, yeah, it can be stemmed from a man. So typically, you know, getting him treatment, using condoms for a while to allow both reproductive systems to recover is very important.
So men can be the carrier of something that they have no idea they have, and women become the incubator of that because it's inside,
well,
and it's moist.
That's an interesting word, incubator. It has to do with our anatomy. Again, the inside of the vagina is like the inside of your mouth. There
right.
is no skin layer. The man's anatomy, because the penis has skin, right?
Right.
That's why women are always more susceptible. It has to do purely based with our anatomic structures.
Okay. Well, on that same subject, tell me about HPV, and do you believe that young women should get the HPV vaccine?
Yes, I'm so glad because, again, here we are talking about anatomic structures and HPV. So that's why it's much easier for a man to transfer HPV to a woman than a woman to a man, just, again, based on the skin and mucosal membrane anatomy of the vagina versus the penis. I do believe in the HPV vaccine. When you look at cervical cancer rates now, again, cervical cancer rates are higher in Black women.
Okay.
But we have tools such as the HPV vaccine that not only can protect you against cervical and vaginal cancer. People forget there are things such as vaginal cancer, vulvar cancer, the skin on the outside of a woman. But even for men, esophageal cancer, rectal cancer. So I when there are tools and things that we can use to cut down these disparities, cut down disease, reduce people dying, then yes.
Okay.
We want to advocate for that.
Okay.
And especially now, remember, before we could only give you the vaccine up until you were 26 years of age. And now we expanded the age range. We waited on the research and the studies to come out. And so I remember when it first came out, Brian, I had men calling my office. People wanted it. And so it's an important thing that now we are vaccinating both men and women.
Oh, wow.
HPV causes penile cancer. It is the cause of cancer of the penis. And so it's an important thing for men's health also.
Now, is there a certain age that you don't need it, or you just, you know what I mean? Are you, but I think younger people are more susceptible than older. Is a cutoff 45 or 50 or 50? Like, what is the cutoff? Or is there one?
The cutoff is 40.
Okay.
And yes, young women and girls definitely can be more susceptible. Women are, as I stated, more susceptible. The immune system changes. So that's why we would tell people, if you got HPV, if you contracted HPV and you were 30 years or older, the likelihood of it resolving was very high. It would not. You'd likely have it. Right?
Okay.
If you're younger and you get HPV, it can act as a transient infection sometimes, right? If you're in your early 20s, late teens, it may go away. There is a chance it may go away. But if you're 30, we don't consider that old, but the immune system is always changing per our age.
Okay. I dated someone that had a problem with fibroids, and it really did affect our physical intimacy. What are fibroids, and is there any truth that Black women are more susceptible to getting them than white women, and why?
Yeah, absolutely. So Black women are more susceptible. So women of African descent, it has to do with our African heritage. So women of African descent, but however, Asian women, Caucasian women, any woman can get fibroids. It's just more common in women of African descent. Fibroids are tumors of the uterus. So the uterus is the womb, right, is a organ made of muscle. And fibroids are typically tumors made of muscle.
Okay.
So I just first want to ground and root every people. Fibroids grow from the uterus because people think the ovaries and, the structures of the woman's reproductive system can be confusing to folks. So they are tumors that grow from the uterus. Most commonly they cause menstrual issues or bleeding, but they also can cause pain, back pain. Pain with intercourse.
Right.
And so, but very common. But there are treatments available. Not always surgery is needed. It's distinctly dependent on where the fibroids are. So that's why an assessment with a gynecologist is so important when you have those.
Yeah, I think a lot of men are lost in that women become emotional and they become very insecure. It's very difficult emotionally for women when they're going through this, especially when it causes pain and bleeding, because guys are impatient. And I think the biggest thing that I learned from it is to be patient and be empathetic, because it's a thing that men never have to go through. And I didn't know anything about it until I experienced it with this person.
All right. I would love for you to say that again. Be patient and what else?
Empathetic.
Be empathetic. There you go. Be patient, be empathetic, because also for a woman with, for childbearing purposes and for her future reproduction. And so fibroids don't always preclude that. Again, it's very important to understand with your physician where, you know, the location, the size of the fibroids, a full assessment needs to be done. Right. Sometimes we do nothing about them. They could be small and asymptomatic. It could be years before a woman even knows she has them. But, of course, it can be a very sensitive issue for women to deal with and manage.
Certainly was. I learned the hard way because I wasn't patient and I wasn't empathetic. So I had to learn that. So full disclosure.
As long as you learn.
I learned. All right, so let's switch gears a bit, okay? I want to talk about something that came out recently. And according to the CDC, about 14% of black people in the country over the age of 65 have Alzheimer's, compared to only 10% of white people. Why is that the case?
So this is something we are actually exploring within the organization. We're looking not only at the increased risk of Alzheimer's. So one of the issues that we have, again, is the reluctance of Black people to enroll in clinical trials and clinical research so we can gain more insights and answers around these types of things. So we know that, again, you and I started out this conversation talking about healthcare disparities, mm-hmm. right? Okay. This is another area where we see that disparity with Black people. It could be some due to other comorbidities. We know that hypertension and other disease states can contribute to your dementia risk, right?
Right.
We know that lifestyle can contribute to your dementia risk. Family history, genetics, so all these interplay, but there's definitely more push to get more Black patients enrolled in clinical research so this can be thoroughly studied. And then we also look at the access to treatment. We know that early intervention when there's dementia is also a very key and important role when you think about the progression of the disease.
So when you talk about dementia, I thought that was something that progressed on its own. It's not something that you could slow down or stop. Is that not the case?
There are treatments that you can slow down and stop dementia. As you know, there are different types of dementia.
Okay.
Most people are very common with Alzheimer's. There's dementia could be caused by prior strokes and other things, vascular disease. But yes, there are treatments and methods, and we know lifestyle, you know, not smoking, exercising regular. There are things that we can do to help reduce our risk for dementia also. And so that's why I'm a big proponent on preventive health, especially for our communities.
Well, we've heard all kinds of things. It has to do with Black people's diets. I don't know if that's the case. It's drinking sodas, eating a lot of processed foods. It seems like the medical community kind of grasps at things when it comes. No offense to you, but I'm just trying to figure out, is there anything other than access to care, healthcare, which is a big thing? Is there anything else that's across the board that, you know, maybe we could do to help prevent that in the Black community?
It's prevention, right?
Okay.
It's the prevention and the control and the management of your diabetes. It's the prevention and the control of your hypertension and taking your meds so you don't have a stroke. And it's the prevention and control of all those two things, which can also lead to chronic kidney disease and all those other morbidities and disease states that we suffer from more commonly that can contribute, right, to that. And so, again, that's why prevention, compliance with your meds, and doing what you can do optimally for your own personal health are so important.
It alarmed me because, you know, although you're in Dallas, I'm based out of Baltimore, and mm-hmm. the highest numbers of dementia in the cities, with Baltimore being one of them, and Miami-Dade County, Florida, and the Bronx, New York. What does that come from?
So when it came to those cities, so we knew when, you know, the East and the Southeast had higher rates of Alzheimer's dementia. And then you're right, Baltimore City, Miami, some of it had to do with aging population.
Okay.
That was a big year for for Baltimore. Also, Black and Hispanic populations, another large contributor when you come to it. But what I hope we can walk away from getting that information from that study is that there are going to be resources, allocation, and more research into why.
Okay.
Right? We know some of it, right? We know some of it when you talk about Black communities and other healthcare issues. But we really begin to dive in and now really begin to have another elevated conversation about the why.
Okay.
Exactly. Because you know, anyone who lives in Baltimore is going to be like, why? What is it? Is there
exactly.
a water? Is it, you know, you're
right,
gonna question
right.
that. I really hope that your state health departments and all of that really work collaboratively on really getting that information out. You know, they have data, they have resources, they have some insights. You know, it took external this study to be done, but we hope that there will be answers that come back to that community to help them protect themselves.
What are a couple of the signs, and I know I'm taking up your time, but what are a couple of the signs that my listeners can look for in their grandparents or in their parents that might be a sign if they are suffering from dementia?
Absolutely. I have my favorite human in the world is my uncle, and my family is going through it now. And our first bout was, you know, he got lost. Driving every day, taking care of himself, and he literally got lost.
Okay.
And couldn't get back home. And so, of course, we know that forgetfulness, that may start with just, where did I put my keys, and misplacing things, it recall. And we know we're all going to get some of that with age. But again, speaking up with it, sometimes going with that person to the doctor, making sure they're sharing, right?
Right.
Many times, it's the advocacy of the family that helps get not only diagnosis, but begin to start treatments to retard the progression of dementia. So it's very important. Sometimes you accompany those older family members to the doctor. Invaluable.
Now, this is going to be the last question, I promise you. But if I didn't ask you this, I wouldn't be doing my job. You are in one of the most stringent abortion law states in the country. How is that affecting you as a gynecologist and what you tell and do for your patients? Or is it?
It does affect what a gynecologist does for their patient here in Texas. And I think my challenge with all of this is the framework around abortion. And so it's come to a place where people ideally think of abortion maybe as just, you know how you talked about earlier, what we ideally see as a picture of who the doctor is,
yes.
but who's getting abortion. And I think people forget how complex a decision that is.
Right.
People forget married couples sometimes seek abortion. It's not always just this Black teenage girl that's pursuing an abortion.
Right.
And so I think the framework around abortion, who gets abortion, and what is abortion. Abortion is healthcare. And so I frame this in termination of pregnancy, right?
Right.
And so pregnancy can be terminated for health concerns of a baby, for health concerns of a mother. And when I say a baby, I'm talking about a baby that may not survive or has a condition. I remember had a patient that the baby was forming without a head, right? No
right.
brain,
right.
no head. We know that that is a condition that is not going to be compatible with life, but to make her proceed and carry a pregnancy all the way without allowing her the grace or the option to terminate early, it reduces her risk for cesarean, hemorrhage, and all those other complications. Because whether you're pregnant with a normal baby or not, you can still get complications of pregnancy. All the body knows is you're pregnant,
right?
Right.
right.
And so framing it in as healthcare and the nuances and the complications we as obstetricians see versus how it's simply put out, you know, just people, we're not advocating for abortion, but we want people to have access because what's been so limiting is the care women may need for miscarriage, ectopic pregnancies, all these other things have been mired in controversy because of the ruling. So it's very complicated here.
Doesn't sound like it's gotten any better either. That's unfortunate.
No, it's not gotten any better.
Well, listen, thank you so much for your time. And I'm going to call on you again. I hope you know that.
Anytime. Anything that I can do to help. I care about community. I care about, I'm looking for a healthy Black America. That is my prayer every night. So thank you for having me today.
Thank you. The new president of the National Medical Association, Dr. Yolanda Lawson. You take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you. Have a great day.
You
Bye-bye.
Do the same. Bye-bye. You know, I'm really glad that I replayed that segment today with Dr. Lawson. It really, you know, the first time I played it, I got a lot of feedback. Apparently, it really helped some people, especially the guys, right? So I'm glad I ran it back. But I know you hear the music, and that can only mean one thing. Again, it's time for the Petty. Let's see what the Petty's talking about this week.
Good morning, Brother B, Brother B. How are you? Happy Labor Day weekend to you.
It is the Petty. It is the Petty. Thank you, sir. Happy Labor Day weekend to you. I mean, you're the hardest working man in show business. So are you having some time off for this weekend?
Yes, I am.
What?
And I still have a weekend off. I'm looking at a little bit of college football, which I will speak about very shortly.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm going to, you know, take it easy, enjoy a little bit of the weather, a little bit of this Labor Day weekend holiday. Right. I mean, you know, it's a holiday to... you know, for us to just sit back and relax.
There you go.
The weather's supposed to be nice. You know, it's all about us working to take the day off to celebrate our working days.
Right.
So yes, I'm enjoying Labor Day weekend.
Okay, okay. All right.
So I want to start off talking about, you know, I already know what I'm going to start off talking about. You know, I'm going to talk, you know, listen, it's my time of year, man. I'm excited.
Right.
You know, I've been waiting on this for a long time. I've been waiting on it since the Super Bowl.
Yes, you have.
But you know what? I kind of fell out with basketball. I fell out with hockey. I fell out with baseball. But in 2021, there was a team out in Las Vegas that renewed my interest in hockey. And I'm talking about those Golden Knights. You know, I've been talking about them. And to see them win the Stanley Cup was fantastic.
Okay.
Because I like that team. And so my interest in hockey has been renewed. But you know what, Brother B? I'm now falling back in love with baseball because of your high-flying O's. Man, oh, man. Those boys are getting done. And you know, let me tell you something, Brother B. Listen to some sports radio talk recently. And they're talking about how the Phillies are really coming along and looking like they might be going back to the World Series. And they were talking about teams who they may be facing in the World Series from the American League.
Right.
They talked about Texas. They talked about Houston. But you know who they really barely talked about? The Orioles. And they were saying, where did this team come from? And I'm just like surprised. I'm flabbergasted because they are the second best team in baseball. They are the beast of the American League, not to mention the American League East. And how are you talking about Houston and Texas and not the Orioles?
Yeah, that's weird to me. Now, were you listening to WIP? Is that who we're listening to?
It doesn't matter who I was listening to. The bottom line is this. They have been talking about those boys as much as I have been talking about them. And I told you this back in April, Brother B, them boys are going to make some noise. And everybody doubted me. They said, well, you know, it's early in the season. Well, guess what, Brother B? They're winning the last month of the season, and they are right where they need to be.
Yeah, yeah. What are like 83 and 50 or something crazy?
Yes,
like that?
They are, brother. And I told you guys back in April, watch out for that team. Nobody believed me. Everybody doubted me. They said it was too early. I like that team. Yes, they're a young team. Yes, they're a team of a bunch of no names. Well, they're not no names to me, but man. And let me say this to the people of Baltimore. I am very disappointed in that fan base because I'm telling you right now, up here in Philadelphia, they fill up their stadium for a wild card team, and Baltimore's not filling up their stadium for a team.
But wait a minute
series.
Now. Hold up. Saturday night last week, they sold the stadium out. Okay.
Wow, really? It's about time.
Yeah, they sold the stadium out, okay? And I believe one of the White Sox, is that who you, no, you weren't watching it. You didn't go to the White Sox game, did you?
It was the Rockies.
The Rockies. Well, during the White Sox series, they sold a game out, too. And that was a weeknight game, I thought.
Wow, it's about time. I mean, this team is hot. They're on fire.
Yeah, they are. They are.
I mean, they should be selling out that stadium every night.
I agree with you.
They are a team that's on fire.
I agree.
Well, all right. Enough about my love affair with the Orioles.
Well, I got one more question for you, though.
How do you think
they're going to fare now that Bautista is on the injured reserve list?
I was very concerned about that, but I think the manager's got a couple of tricks up his sleeves to make something happen. Batista is really just only on a 15-day injury list.
Oh, okay.
It's a possibility he will be back.
Okay.
And we're gonna keep up on that, because when I was at that game when he was injured, and I said, if he can't come back for the postseason, Dorio's in trouble.
Right.
But now I've learned that he's only on the 15-day DL, so hopefully he will be back and ready for the postseason, because they're going to need that guy.
Absolutely.
They definitely want to need him.
Okay.
So before I get into the football thing, I'm going to talk about something that's close to you, and that's boxing.
Yes, sir.
Errol Spence has decided to invoke his rematch clause in the contract he had with Terrence Crawford.
That. I heard that.
Now, that's a good move, but I think he's going to get the brakes beat off of him again.
I think it's going to be worse this time, honestly.
It probably will be, because from what I understand, they're going to be fighting in a different weight class.
Right.
Now, on another note, speaking of Terrence Crawford, he's looking at possibly fighting Canelo Alvarez or one of the Charlo brothers.
Who, Crawford?
That should be interesting. Yes, he is.
Yeah. But so, Canelo would have to come down, and he's going to come up, and they're going to meet at a catch weight, I believe.
Let me tell you something, Brother B. That'd be a big money fight.
Yeah, a huge money fight.
That would be a big one. A huge one. So we'll continue to watch that development as it happens.
Okay.
And then track and field, we got to talk about Sha'Carri Richardson. You know, she already said, I ain't back. Everybody kept saying, this is a comeback. She's back. She came back. She said, no, I'm just better.
Right.
Taking the 100 meters, not once, but twice over the Jamaicans. And the young lady's just like, after the little scandal she had with the, you know, not making the Olympic team and the marijuana use and all, and getting smoked in one of the, you know, big races, girlfriend has come back and she's just like, look, I'm letting y'all know, y'all got to deal with me.
Yeah, they definitely do. And Shelly Fraser Price, she's on her way out. But Sharika Jackson, they thought was going to be the crowning Jamaican, and it looks like Sha'Carri's got her number, so we'll see what happens.
She definitely does. And that young lady, she's got wings on her feet. She's got jets on her ass, whatever you want to say.
Right.
She's smoking them.
She definitely smoking them. Hey, but speaking of that, right, what about Noah Lyles and his comment about about the world championship? You know, he said that the NBA is the world champions of what? Because they don't.
Well, that's what in any sport. They say world champions in baseball. They say it in football. They say it in basketball. Now, to be honest with you, Brother B, they could play world championship games in baseball and in basketball. If we're talking about world championships in football, you're basically just talking about the Canadian Football League and the NFL.
Right.
But I understand his comment. It makes sense. You want to start talking about world champions, play baseball world champions, play basketball world champions.
Right. That's
and, you know, if the CFL and the NFL can come to some type of agreement, make it happen.
It'll never happen, but I understand.
Now, here's one that's kind of sad, that I've never been a big college football fan, because like I said, it's just too many teams out there, too many conferences. But the Pac-12, that used to be one of the best conferences out on the West Coast, has basically died.
Okay.
Stanford, Cal, and SMU have decided to leave the Pac-12, only leaving really now is the Pac-2, because there's only two teams left in the Pac-12, which used to be the Pac-12. And here's the thing that gets me. Why is Stanford and Cal coming to the ACC, which is, from my understanding, the Atlantic Coast Conference?
Yeah, that makes no sense. It's all a money grab.
No sense whatsoever. It is. It's a money thing. I don't like it. Like I said, I was never a big college football fan. I really kind of started watching to see who the best players were coming out that would be going into the NFL draft. And now we got this nonsense going on where teams are leaving what's what historically known traditional conferences.
Right.
The Pac-12 is now dead. It's a sad thing to see.
It is, definitely.
Now let's start talking about what you know I love when I'm talking about the NFL. And we're going to start with not the Redbirds, and I'm talking about those Cardinals, who people are saying is going to be tanking this year. How do you tank in football? Well, we're going to find out to see if those Redbirds will be tanking, because I understand the little big-head midget will not be starting the first game of the season.
Yeah, I heard the same thing.
I'm not going to talk about those Dirty Birds down in the ATL, starting with some guy named Riddler, whatever his name is, that quarterback. I ain't going to talk about them. I'm not going to talk about those Philadelphia Pigeons, who people are picking to be going back to the Super Bowl.
Because of their offensive line.
Well, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that shit. I'm not going to talk about those sea chickens out in Seattle.
Okay. Okay. Even though you like Pete Carroll.
Yeah, and I think they may win the NFC West with Geno out there. But right. We're going to talk about some Angry Birds, and you already know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about your Baltimore Ravens, and that's why I call them Angry Birds, because they make y'all angry by the way they lose games. But anywho, they have a tradition down in Baltimore with a free agent or rookie comes in. He stands up, he says his alma mater. He may have to sing the school song, but he talks about if he has a signing bonus or not. And I don't know if you know or not, it's been out there that Zay Flowers floored everyone, but he said his signing bonus was $7 million.
Right. I know it floored Odell Beckham Jr. I know he had something
to say about it. Yes, it did. And you know what? I think that young man is a good fit for that team. I think right. The Ravens really got it right by choosing him and being one of the receivers. I hope he stays healthy. Hope he does great things down there in Baltimore with Lamar Jackson. I really do. And like I said, I'm not a big Raven fan. You know that. But I think something might be cooking down in Baltimore. Not to mention, I heard a little something that about the Chiefs, who I'm going to talk about in a couple of minutes. They might not be the top team. I mean, they are the top team, but they better watch out for the Bengals, the Bills, and the Baltimore Ravens. Those are three teams that could knock them off the top of the hill. And they talked about the Ravens. They talked about Lamar Jackson. They talked about their offense. You know, Baltimore is getting big news for the football team and not the baseball team. And it just baffles me because right. The Orioles are hot and the Ravens are who they are.
Well, I mean, you know, you can't talk about, I know you think they're bum birds, but they're not bum birds, bro. The Ravens have brought a lot of excitement to the city when the Orioles were not. So you just can't. You can't flip-flop it like that. Right now, we have,
well,
I believe,
I'm
two
doing
contenders.
It because I'm looking at those high-flying O's, and I see those bum birds in the purple and black every week do what they do.
Come
bumble,
on,
stumble, and barely make it to the finish line. And you know I'm right when I say that. Speaking of another team people are going to be looking at, those J-E-T-S, Jets, and Aaron Rodgers. As a matter of fact, in game one, when they faced the Buffalo Bills, the real team that's from New York, they're picking the Jets to possibly win the Bill, beat the Bills.
The Jets have never turned me on, bro. Like, there's something, that team has never turned me on. I don't care who is starting quarterback. They've just never had a team that turned me on. That made me want to watch.
I did like them when Rex Ryan was the coach. I did like that. I liked the fact that he took them to an AFC championship game. And after that, they've just been like doormats to everyone.
Yeah.
But now, you're talking about Aaron Rodgers, a quarterback, with Zach Wilson, who ran his mouth, who has that beautiful woman as a mother, came to New York and thought he was going to set it on fire, and he ended up being a dud. And now you got Aaron Rodgers up there. And we all know what Aaron Rodgers can do. You know, I think the Jets have a nice young team. They have a nice nucleus there. They have a nice coach. And I think that they are going to challenge the Bills. They're going to surprise a lot of people in the AFC this year.
I'll tell you what's going to happen. This is my prediction. During the early weeks of the NFL season, Rodgers is going to do well because it's going to be warm. As soon as it starts to get cold and starts playing in cold weather situations, he's going to be horrible. Because he's older, and it happens to every single older quarterback. It happened to Favre. It started happening to Brady. It happens to every older quarterback. The mobility, they lose mobility. They lose arm accuracy and strength. Watch what I tell you.
Yeah, Brother B, he played in the frozen freaking tundra.
I know.
I do not think he will have a problem up in New Jersey.
But his numbers started to decline up in Green Bay,
true,
which is why he's with the Jets.
It's a whole different type of cold out in Wisconsin than
okay.
It is in New Jersey.
Okay.
So I think he'll fare just fine up in the Meadowlands.
We'll see.
And finally, let's talk about next Thursday night. Oh my goodness, it is the beginning of the season. Yes, yes, yes. Those pesky Lions travel to Arrowhead to play the defending champions, the Kansas City Chiefs. Man, oh man, Thursday night football, the first game of the season, you got the Lions and the Chiefs. And a lot of people may say that is a big old mismatch, I beg to differ.
I don't think
and
so.
And you know
either.
Why I beg to differ? Because I look at the line. The line is only, and I'm talking about the point spread, and I said the line
right.
is only 6.5. And the Chiefs are at home,
yeah,
defending champions, and they're only giving up 6.5 points, which is basically just a touchdown.
I don't think it's a big mismatch either. I really don't.
I kind of believe that those teams are evenly matched. And let me tell you something, Brother B. If Chris Jones is not on that field, it's going to make a big difference for those Chiefs.
Right.
The Lions are young. I like the coach. And you know, I was calling them the pesky Lions all year last year. They knocked Green Bay out of the playoffs. They just missed making the playoffs themselves. And I think they're going to make a lot of noise. I'm, like I said, I'm kind of picking them to be a wild card team and challenge the Vikings in the NFC North this coming season. The over is 54.5. And if you're a betting man, yeah, take the over. Don't worry about the points. There's going to be a lot of points scored in that game. I'm thinking 54.5 points, yeah, that's done.
Okay.
Take the over in that game. And also, if you're picking money line, take the Chiefs. Now, that's the first game of the season. You know, I was kind of like Mr. Thursday night last year because my predictions were straight on for Thursday nights. So there you have it. Take the Chiefs in game one of the NFL season. Next week, I will talk to you. We will break down what happened on Thursday night. And we'll talk about every game that's going to be played next Sunday. And man, oh man, I'm excited. It's my time of year. And oh yeah, you know I'm going to talk a little baseball. Because as long as those O's stay hot, I'm going to talk about it.
I hear you, brother.
On that note, Brother B, enjoy the rest of your weekend. Happy Labor Day to you. I am out of here. Peace.
Peace, brother. Peace. Woo! The Petty is fired up. I mean, I love when he's fired up like that. He's got me ready to play. But look, I want to thank you for being here today, especially the guys that had the questions that said they were going to tune in today. I hope you did actually tune in and learn the things that you had questions to me about on IG. I don't, you know what I'm saying? I am not the master, so I had to replay it for you guys. And hopefully, you know, you learned something. Also, to the ladies, some of you guys disagree with some of the things that Dr. Lawson said, and that's okay. Feedback is everything for me. I pass those things on to her, or I will actually pass those things on to her, the questions that you had. So please keep sending them to me. Hit me up at On with Brian Pettaway, or just hit me up on Facebook with Brian Pettaway, and I'll make sure that any questions you have, I'll answer them for you if I can, or get the answers for you. But I will follow up with you because, you know, feedback is everything. So I appreciate you being here today. The hour is coming to a close. Here's the other thing that's coming to a close. My one-year anniversary. The one-year anniversary of my show is next week. So I've got a great show for you lined up for next week. I'm not going to tell you what it is yet. But can you believe the year has gone by so fast? So today and tomorrow, please relax because that's what I'm going to do. Relax. Take a load off. Do nothing if you possibly can. But like I always say, the best part about doing nothing, and I say this every Sunday, and I've been saying it for a year. That sounds crazy. But for a year, every Sunday, the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. So wake up on Tuesday, conquer the world, make the week a great week for you, make life better than it's ever been for you, and just have an amazing time because life is short and it is meant to be lived. So live it and have yourself an amazing week, people. Listen, I got to get out of here. Take care. See you next week. Peace.